Welcome, everyone, to Film Strips, the podcast about, you know, people who are screwed from frame one. I'm Dave Babbitts.
And I'm Andrew Kanigiser.
By the way, we spoil things on this show.
Spoiler alert, the podcast.
Yeah. No, it just didn't occur to me that, like, this is the second film I think we've done where that's kind of a theme.
Well, yeah. It's kind of funny, actually, because I remember being, I guess, old enough that with Web 1.0, how eventually someone decided, hey, why don't we just recap the plots of movies and get along with all the twists and the craziness going on. And then yesterday, I found sort of its progeny, basically, trying to pick out a spooky movie to watch with the lady friend. And the movie The Invitation came up. And it's weird for two ways, because we got into an argument over whether or not it was going to be scary. And I'm like, there's got to be some way we can find out. And sure enough, where's thejump.com? Friend of the show. Consent pending. That'll basically time code and list off what's happening before every film specifically has a jump scare in it. And then it's even weirder, though, because I started watching The Invitation, and about 8 minutes in, I realized, wait a second, I've seen this movie before.
Yeah, you're the one who told me not to watch it, even though I still plan fully on doing it.
Okay. Well, it's weird, because I'm like, I remember looking at this movie before, I remember watching that movie, only after I was reminded of its general plot parameters. So it's weird, but thanks to movie spoilers on Wikipedia, I was able to remember that, yes, I have seen it. Yeah, that wasn't really tied in with the show or anything. It's really, I guess it's my turn to rabbit hole this week. And why shouldn't I, David? Because I'm in the driver's seat.
Well, you are, but I guess we should probably give everyone a little bit of a heads up as to where we're going this time. So last week, we took a look at a little film called Machine Gun McCain, which we both came away with the absolute belief that it is thoroughly mediocre and eh?
Yeah, I think David's poll quote was, yep, that was a movie.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, from that point, though, you decided that we were going to follow one Britt Eklund away from this Italian movie shot in America to a completely different country in the globe. And where did you take us, Andrew?
Well, I took us to the jolly old United Kingdom, specifically to a little coastal village called Summer Isle. And that means, for the trained listener, we're looking at the 1973 film directed by Robin Hardy, The Wicker Man. Not to be confused with, was it Neil LaBute who remade it? Yeah. So The Wicker Man is a film that a lot of us, you know, people in our generation know for probably the wrong reasons. I mean, a supercut of Nicolas Cage being Nicolas Cage. That tends to leave an impression. But what not everybody, I realize, is aware, The Wicker Man is a remake, and the 1973 version is what we're looking at today.
Yes, that's right. The 1973 film, directed by Robin Hardy, and written by Anthony Schaefer, somebody who's had some very interesting credits, which I'm sure we'll get to in a bit. But, yeah, so, I guess, Andrew, to get us started off here, this is your pick, so why did we come to Scotland's piece of, or slice of horror fiction?
Yes, the Scottish country. We don't want to curse this episode. I watched The Wicker Man for the first time during my undergrad, and I really enjoyed it. It made a very strong impression, and, you know, in subsequent conversations with you, I realized, well, it made an impression on you, too. But I also wanted to pull something to counterbalance Machine Gun McCain, where we had no idea what the movie was, we weren't all that interested, it was next to impossible to find any critical research beyond what was listed on the wiki. So, and I also thought this might be an interesting opportunity to talk about horror film proper, and sure enough, spoiler alert, it's a horror slash film. But yeah, and above all, I know that you are pretty much a lifelong horror buff, and you have a certain personal connection to this film, do you not?
Sort of, because last year I ended up taking a trip with my girlfriend and her family to the one and only Scotland, and in the course of 2 weeks, we crammed in a ton of places. Now, is part of the lead up and planning to that. They had been before, so they kind of knew some areas they wanted to hit and some places that they hadn't seen already, but they wanted to go, and they were asking for my input on, you know, places I'd like to see. Now, anybody who knows me knows I'm kind of a homebody. I don't travel much. I am not a worldly person in the sense of having made extensive travel across this globe of ours. Except, of course, within this podcast format, as you've no doubt noticed.
Well, don't tell people that, David. You come off as so worldly. Everyone will believe it until you announce it.
Ah, true. Them's the breaks. But, yeah, in this instance, when I was thinking about locations or places in Scotland to go and see, you know, nothing was immediately jumping to mind, except being a hardcore film fan. I started diving to, well, what are some iconic locations from horror or from a film in Scotland that I would want to see? Now, a lot of people might want to see Trainspotting and where they shot some of that film. And believe me, you could find tons of brochures talking about Trainspotting.
I've actually been to Edinburgh. And I only realized after I left the country, oh yeah, this is where Trainspotting is.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, films such as even the recent Avengers Infinity War have shot there. We actually came about a couple weeks before they shot there, so we kind of realized afterwards we timed it a little bit wrong. But I digress.
If you're looking in the background for Dave walking into the frame during the climactic Infinity War battle, yeah, sorry. You'll have to wait till the next cycle.
But, what ended up, the locations I sort of encouraged to included one particular castle for its connection to a little film called Highlander.
Of course.
So, of course, I'd like to know, I wasn't the one to bring it up with the tour guide when we were there. They brought it up themselves, so I take no blame there. And the other one was a number of locations from The Wicker Man, which, you know, we ended up getting to see. And we didn't see, you know, all of them. There were, again, we were sort of trying to work with when our framework here is. But I did get to see a number of the key locations from there, including Culleen Castle, which I believe that's the proper pronunciation. I think the Z is silent in there. Where Lord Summerisle's mansion from the film is, and the grounds, including the sort of flower beds and everything.
Oh, wow. What do you think rent on a place like that is?
Oh, it would be astronomical.
I figured as much.
Yeah, and probably my favorite location for the beach scene and the cave scenes that happen on the beach, the location of St. Ninian's Cave. And I'll save it for when we get there, because like I said, that was probably the highlight of the trip for me. Because I have to say this, if nothing else, I salute Robin Hardy and the entire crew of that film for shooting on that beach. Because it may have changed a bit since 1973, but based upon what I'm seeing today, that would not have been an easy feat to do at the time.
Well, it's like the famous quote says, I hate sand. It's coarse and it's rough and it gets everywhere.
And there is basically no sand on it. It's like all stone. Every little bit of it, like, they're just stones. Now, some of those may have been added in the years between Wicker Man and my arrival there. But even putting that aside, St. Ninian's Cave itself, you know what, screw it. I'm just going to spoil it there. For those who've seen the film, there's the shot where you see a bunch of people exiting the beach after they make the sacrifice of beer to the sea. And then Howie finds someone, we'll get into the spoilers later, dives into the cave.
David, you can't tell an anecdote about the end of the film without spoiling it. You gotta commit.
All right, fine. When Howie grabs the girl he spends the entire film looking for, and they run into the cave trying to escape, let me say this, that is a lie. It's a beautifully constructed lie, but it's a lie, because when you go to St. Ninian's Cave, like, you're basically looking at a dent in the wall. Like, and it's also a place of religious pilgrims, so you see a lot of people who have put coins or crosses in that there as well, so...
Maybe that's why the entrance is so small. It's blocked up with all these gold coins.
Well, not, like I said, it's... But again, it's basically just an indent in the wall. Like, when you say cave, you kind of picture what's shown in the film, which is this, you know, cavernous thing. That's not St. Ninian's Cave. It's awesome to go and see, believe me, but it is like, I salute them for constructing that lie, but you have to walk like a solid 30 minutes to get down to that beach from where you park, and it is just like a brutal walk in terms of just going as one steep, super narrow path in order to get there. So I'm just imagining the film crew lugging all the equipment down for that thing and just cursing Rob Hardy and the location or the location scout on this film.
But this is also a film where they necessitated that they had to build an enormous man made out of wicker, so
which
apparently it that far.
Yeah, sadly I didn't get to see the location where that was. Apparently after they burnt the Wicker Man, they actually just let the legs of the thing, which had survived, stand for a long, long time. It was just sort of a place everybody would go and see. But according to the locals I ran into when I happened to drop that, that was kind of one of the reasons we were there. They noted that the legs are no longer there because apparently some youth ended up lighting the bloody things on fire to burn the rest of it to the ground so nothing exists anymore.
Lousy youth. Didn't we learn anything from Sergeant Howie?
Oh, well. But, so, yeah, if you've actually managed to survive the past 11 minutes...
I was going to say, it's a half-hour walk to the beach, and that's only three times as long as it's taken us to begin talking about the film. We're doing better than some weeks, though.
This is true. So, Andrew, so why don't you reorient this ship and actually get us on a path that isn't the path to that beach.
Yes. So often we talk about horror, when we think about the classics of horror, we often think in a purely North American context. There are a lot of reasons for that, I think. First off, just the saturation of the market. But also, there's something very culturally specific about horror. In fiction, in literature, in cinema, there's always something very localized about it. And I think that speaks to, if we ask ourselves, well, horror, what function does it really serve? I mean, you'll have people talk about roller coasters and say, oh, well, it's fun to be scared. And I mean, that idea holds water to a point, but I think it was Paul F. Tompkins pointed out, well, that means if somebody puts on a ski mask and jumps out of an alley when you're walking to your car as a hilarious prank, you know, how come you're not having the time of your life? So, horror studies, it's... As a genre, it's always been kind of one of the sort of bastardized children, where for the longest time, horror falls strictly on like commercially quick turnaround exploitation films. You know, your monster movies, your B movies, we all know who they are. But horror, generally, there's pretty much the two main arguments about it. Going back to Freud, scholars like Robin Wood, they talk about horror as it's fundamentally linked to the repressed or the disavowed. When Freud uses the term the uncanny, that's sort of what it's getting at. The monster on the screen is never just the monster itself, but there's a sort of representative function to it as well. Basically, the monster is there to reflect the things that we as a society want to keep buried. And so it's terrifying because it plays up those culturally specific fears, but it's also therapeutic and kind of cathartic because we see it on screen and then through the narrative, we contain and resolve that threat.
Yeah, I think it was Stephen King who pointed out that, you know, part of the reason we go to horror films is it's a way to basically... Again, it's to confront what's deep down that we are all scared to talk about, but in a safe, controlled way. I mean, even if even if it's a film that ends on a downer or a bleak note or a story that really disturbs you, it's still just a story, ultimately.
True. Though I do know several people who refuse to watch any kind of horror movie where the bad guy gets away at the end, especially when it's like rather stripped down ones. So that's why, like, you'll see movies like The Strangers pop up on Scariest Movies Ever list. I think I fell asleep through it. I do that a lot sometimes. But yeah, so basically, this reading of horror, or sort of this argument for its importance, it basically assumes that, you know, every... I mean, it seems banal, but it's worth being said. Every single country has its own culture, its own norms, its own... history of societal development, and they're not all the same. So it only logically follows that the things the society is going to be concerned with, its values, and things that stand in opposition to those values are going to be different. And if you want to read that sort of filmically, you know, again, we're both old enough to remember about 10 years ago where with the J-horror boom, you all of a sudden had a whole bunch of smaller American studios trying to take popular Japanese horror properties, make a transnational adaptation of it, get them out the door. And most of them were terrible, even though like they had a pretty strong amount of fidelity to the original. And I think that just illustrates the things that one nation finds terrifying, while the other one they just see as sort of bothersome. But yes, you weigh in, David.
Well, no, I mean, you're not wrong. I mean, it's certainly, I mean, to come back to your example there of the J-horror boom of the 2000s there, I mean, it's one of those things where when you're going to be transplanting horror, you ultimately end up having to, and not even just, specifically from country to country, but, from a key political or historical moment into another historical moment, you end up having to recontextualize and shift things in order to make it work. You can't simply redo. I mean, there are certain stories where, or spines, I guess, for horror tales, which are strong enough and maybe in some ways, bare enough that they can always be sort of reused. I mean, let's think about how many cabin in the wood type movies where the horror happens that I think actually work quite well and end up being significantly different films, depending upon the generations they come out in, or the various reinterpretations of Dracula. Admittedly, the overwhelming bulk of those are terrible, but there are some really key and interesting significant differences that are worth exploring, and particularly as they get sort of culturally relocated, historically relocated, and politically reinvented.
And that's actually a really good point that you bring up, Dave, where it's not just a matter of geographic relocations, but even the same country making the same film 20 years apart. I mean, the Invasion of the Body Snatchers that we get in the 1950s is a very different film than the one Philip Kaufman makes in the 1970s, especially
Which
when you think about horror as somehow being reflective of like the concerns of the time. You know, there are universal threads in horror that, well, generally people are always going to find scary, but some of them only really work within that certain context.
No, absolutely. And I mean, it's certainly, why I think probably within, more than most genres, I mean, and not just for commercial purposes, why remakes tend to happen within horror so often, because even though I think 9 times out of 10, the end results are completely misguided and come from a very weird, cynical place that isn't helpful. I mean, there is something to be said for the idea of transplanting and updating terrors for our cultural moment. Again, a key example I think that does work. The 80s, I think, gave us two of the perfect examples, which is John Carpenter's The Thing, which is an update of the Howard Hawks film, The Thing from Another World, and David Cronenberg's update of the 1958 classic The Fly, which is a completely different beast from its predecessor, and in many ways the superior film
I think in
overall.
every imaginable way, the superior film, but that's
Yeah.
also just me. So I guess that's because we've looked at horror or sort of texts that are ru rubbing shoulders with horror, but most of them, again, in a North American context. And so I know I've had enough conversations with you about the Hammer years and the British horror scene and all these weird little properties that no one seems to remember but Dave. And so I figured it would be interesting to take a look at sort of a more pure horror coming from an international context. And that's sort of what brings us to the Wicker Man here.
Yeah, and I gotta say, it's kind of interesting you say a pure horror, because in many ways, The Wicker Man is, in one hand, it is very much a straight-up horror film, but it is so unconventional.
There's a lot of idiosyncrasies with this one. And again, the idea was, hey, we'll go with a classic horror film. And
Yeah.
sure enough, in the first 10 minutes of viewing, you're like, maybe not so much.
Well, and this is the thing. Again, spoilers ahead. Not that I haven't already spoiled this film pretty hardcore in the first 11 minutes of, or, well, hell, the first 30 seconds of this episode. Yeah, no, The Wicker Man is the short version of this of the plot, and I think this is actually one of the few films that's re that we've done where it is very easy to summarize the plot. Is about a
Or, if I may, to summarize the plot.
Ba-dum-dum. But yeah, it's a very straightforward narrative. The film is about a police sergeant from the Scotland Yard, played by Edward Woodward. Edward Woodward of Equalizer fame. The series that inspired the Denzel Washington movies. Yeah, he plays Sergeant Howie, this deeply religious police sergeant who's coming to Summer Isle, this isolated little isle off the coast of Scotland, to investigate the disappearance of a young girl. He's been sent a letter about this, he arrives on the island, and the film basically follows his investigation as he comes to realize, A, the entire inhabitants of this isle seem to be worshipping a sort of, as you put it in the notes, Andrew, neo-pagan religion here, detailing with heavily with fertility and its relationship to nature, and B, starting to suspect that the disappearance of this girl may be related to these practices.
Because nominally the film, like... It basically begins from the moment that Howie arrives on the island, and aside from the differing versions, which we'll probably get into at the end, but everything we're told about what has come before is just relayed in dialogue. So yes, he's received this letter that's apparently from the girl's mother, and includes a picture. He's sent to investigate, but immediately the film positions things as being a little off. And not just like that almost slapsticky sequence of him yelling from the seaplane to the men on the shore to send a boat, and like this almost Beckett-esque failure to communicate. But the second he gets on shore, none of the townspeople he shows the photo to recognize the girl. Yeah. And this is a film that there is a reason for it. It teases the audience where no one recognizes the photo, but the girl's mother, who allegedly sent the letter, is there, so go talk to her. And everything ends up being another red herring. So the mother denies sending the letter. He goes to the schoolhouse. They deny that the girl was ever registered in their classes. And this mystery keeps building. And and it leads him directly to Lord Summer Isle, played by the one and only Christopher Lee, rocking probably the most 1973 hairdo of all time. Yes, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think my description to you in a text was hippie Carl Sagan.
Yeah, if the shoe fits, wear it. Yes. Yeah. So Summer Isle reveals that even though he doesn't really give any straight answers about the girl, he explains to Howie the history of Summer Isle, how his grandfather invented a new strain of crop that was more conducive to the island. And he basically he's the early version of Monsanto, and just like Monsanto, in exchange for its wonderful products, he demands servility and loyalty from the people. And he does so by encouraging them to embrace classical pagan rituals, and a lot of that is praying to nature, making, and in some cases possibly human sacrifices.
Yeah, and, the film goes from there, and I mean, to make a sort of, again, because we've already sort of spoiled the hell out of this, to make a long story short, what we come to discover is Howie believes the girl isn't dead, despite all indications that ultimately she was, having already had a grave, which, after finally getting permission to dig it up, discovering that there's just a bunny rabbit corpse in there, not a little girl's corpse. He believes that the girl's still alive because the crops failed, and they need a human sacrifice in order to restore the growth of their crops. He's partly right, as he comes to discover, after failing to find the girl and sort of, what he believes cleverly getting his way into their May Day festival so he can follow things through to its logical conclusion. What he comes to discover is that, no, this entire thing has been a ploy to get somebody that they're going to sacrifice, namely Howie himself, because he fits the bulk of the criteria.
Yeah, he is the perfect sacrifice. The puritanical man of God sent with the authority of the law. He came of his own volition, and during the masquerade, he even disguises himself as the fool. So according to Summer Isle's prophecy, he is the best kind of sacrifice they can make that will guarantee the island's continued survival. And the film ends with, yes, Howie being thrown in a robe, having his face painted, and while everyone cheerfully sings old Celtic folk songs, he recites poem 23 while he burns to death inside a giant wicker man.
Yeah. Now,
so it ends on a real high note, you know?
Oh, absolutely. And the thing about this film that I think is interesting is there is a version in a parallel universe out there somewhere that is probably matching the description I think many of you are probably having, which is the sort of, you know, sinister dark island with Howie wandering about, you know, digging into deep into the mystery and pulling, having
a lot of shifty glances and flashes of lightning.
Yeah, and clues that he's having to cleverly follow. Like, I mean, the David Fincher version of this movie.
It would also be 4 hours long.
Yeah. But yeah, that's the version I think a lot of people come to. And again, when you can say something is a horror film, you know, I think for many of us, we would definitely default to convention in our mind as to what a horror film is, which is dark and mysterious and probably filled with jump scares and has, you know, overbearing, you know, bombastic score, possibly telling you when you need to be afraid. And people acting very sinisterly.
That is not the film we get here, is it?
Not even remotely, because the horror of this movie, like, it doesn't even really feel necessarily like a what we would consider a conventional horror film up until maybe the final 5 minutes of it.
Yeah, and even then, I mean, going back to, like, the aesthetics or sort of the mise-en-scene of it, it does, like, the polar opposite of what most horror conventions are. So again, instead of, you know, the brooding ominous tone and the dark and stormy night, most of this film is shot in daylight. The soundtrack, which is pretty excellent, music by Paul Giovanni, is a lot of sort of medieval or like Renaissance era folk songs of the area. And, you know, there's this weird tranquility to it, but there's also a sort of intensity as well. And I think given how this film talks about nature, I think that forms like a nice little synchronicity, whether or not by accident, I don't know. But there's no monster. I mean, we can argue about if it telegraphs people's intentions a bit later on. But yeah, like, this is a bright, colorful movie. It's well shot. And I think most notably of all, there are a lot of musical sequences.
Yeah, now this is, like, I kept sort of underscoring, you know, whether we could even call this a horror musical, because it occurs to me, you could actually, there's enough music in this thing that you could do this as a Broadway stage show with minimal changes, and you could probably make something that would legitimately work on the stage just as well as it does on film, because yeah, there is a ton of music. I mean, you get things sort of like the folk music that's that opens the film, that's on the soundtrack. You get a lot of people singing in bars. You have children, you know, running around the May Day, you know, tree, you know, singing about fertility and other things. But then even you get about a good solid 20 or 30 minutes into the film, a full-on musical number, which I refer to as the Disney Princess musical number, except, you know, it's Britt Ekland in the nude singing to ostensibly the audience as she runs about her room, basically singing a song intended to sort of almost siren like call Howie into the room to seduce him.
Well, yeah, it's this ain't your typical musical, if it is. And that's the weird thing. Like, I keep coming back to the music in my own head, where there seems to be a really interesting play whether the music is diegetic or extra diegetic, because again, like, you know, just to, define my terms, diegetic is whether or not an element of the film has a rooting or a source within the frame itself, within the inner story world. So, if a pop song is playing while you're watching a film scene, Scorsese, Goodfellas, you know, when it's playing Layla and it's the montage of everyone turning up dead, that's extra diegetic. But if all of a sudden it cut to a jukebox in the film playing Layla and they turn it off and the music stops, then it's diegetic. This film, all of its musical sequences, They are diegetic, and the first one doesn't come until the pub scene, right?
Yeah.
And nothing has signaled that this is going to happen. And then all of a sudden everybody's taking turns singing about the landlord's daughter and doing this weird little choreographed group dance to it. And it's so cool to me because we as the audience were sort of dumbfounded, like, wait, what is happening right now? And the way that Howie, the character played by Edward Woodward, responds is the exact same. He's basically just like absolutely gobsmacked, for lack of a better word, at just the strangeness all around him. So, I mean, normally, as we talked about with Angel Heart, like the perspective of the audience and the detective is usually closely linked. Here, this is a film where perspective is linked, but also emotional response seems to be linked as well.
Well, yes, because the thing about the film is, if there is a sense of horror or, an approach to horror here, is that it is the absence of the signifiers. Okay, there's almost a normalization of things which, in a traditional horror film, would be underscored as this is sinister. And this film doesn't do it. I mean, there's stuff that's always kind of feels off kilter or odd to the audience because it does sit outside the realm of what we would sort of say a traditional Western audience might expect, in terms of what the morality of a film is or what its sort of perspective on ideas of faith and that may be. And this film, it clearly indicates that the people of Summer Isle are definitely into some different stuff than mainstream culture is for the most part, but not until the last 10 or 15 minutes does it ever really start to feel like does it treat it as if this is inherently sinister per se? It's just everything's off, everything's we a little different, but the film isn't stylized to shoot it as if these are weird individuals. It's just sort of presenting them and letting both Howie and the audience react to them authentically, I guess. It's not underscoring this is what you must feel in this particular precise moment.
Well,
And a
yeah,
large.
it's not heavy-handed in engendering that the sort of resonant emotions with Howie. I just think it may have been completely unintended. I think it works really well when it happens. But you're right, because there's nothing untoward about Summer Isle. Like, it's your typical little village, and they have the typical little schoolhouse, and everyone gets together on the important days to celebrate together. And so, it's not sinister, it's just very strange. And it's only like through conversations that Howie has with the islanders. Only like near the end does he get that detail that makes him go, huh? But I think that's part of how the film maintains its tension so well, because this isn't quite, it's not quite the same sort of ambivalence with a film like Black Swan or the movie it's a remake of, Perfect Blue, where there's that constant is it or isn't it? But I think it asks a slightly different question where, it sort of asks us to reflect on whether or not the values of the islanders, are they really aberrant? Are they problematic views? Are they incompatible with the modern world? And we look at Howie's reaction, and as a fundamentalist Christian, like, he is horrified by what he sees. And like, we almost migrate a little bit from him as he doubles down on the idea that no, there's definitely a conspiracy. Yes, someone is getting sacrificed. Up until the film's reveal, I think it does a really good job of maintaining the idea that maybe he's just overreacting. Maybe he just can't wrap his head around the new ways, man.
Well, and this is the thing, because this film comes out in 1973, which is in the dying days of the counterculture, which was sweeping both the UK and America at large, and this idea of sort of, again, the sort of tune out to, or drop out, tune in. I forget how Timothy Leary phrased it. Point
Tune
being,
in, turn on, drop out.
that's the one I'm looking for. But yeah, that sort of idea of, free love and the capacity to sort of, get back in touch with nature and abandon these sort of traditional structures of what we consider, Western civilization in terms of how we construct family, in terms of how we construct community, and how we construct faith, or our understanding of what faith is. And it's, the film, I mean, it's hard to even want to call it subtext because so much of it feels like it's on the cusp of being text in terms of the mise-en-scène, in terms of what people are wearing, in terms of the behavior. Like, I mean, you have a scene, like what probably one of the big scenes early on in the film where Howie really freaks out is in the pub, after he gets set up his room. He goes wandering in Sarreil after dark, and again, in a different filmmaker's hand, you could see this being played as a real sinister moment, and instead it's played almost like this weird dreamlike sequence of him more or less witnessing an orgy
Yeah.
going
And
on.
you made a really good point in the notes, though, that this is also the only moment in the film, really, that's shot like a conventional horror film.
Yeah, it sort of is, but even then, you're looking and realizing, okay, this is weird, and it's certainly something I wouldn't want to participate in myself. But nobody here seems to be there against their will. Nobody's getting harmed, and the rest of the islanders seem to be pretty, comfortable with everything that's going on. So I totally get Howie being uncomfortable with it, but his sort of freak out about it and how he sort of views this as horrendous and wrong. You start to really, look at Howie, and it's like, okay, he is really a sort of 1950s establishment character who just can't get over the generation gap in a way.
And similarly, when he's at the schoolhouse, no one's acting out. Everyone's excited and engaged with learning, but because he hears the teacher use the word penis, that's when he basically threatens to bring the whole hammer of the law down. And he goes on a tirade about the immorality of it. And again, it's not saying that we're supposed to completely sympathize with anyone in particular. But moments like that, it really underscores. It's like, well, Howie is probably more like us than the people of Summer Isle, and that's a moment where it's like, it's really that big of a deal? It's all bodies, man. So there are those flare-ups where it's like, yeah, it seems like his faith is actually blinding his judgment. And by the end of the film, I think, his faith does blind him to his own ultimate judgment at the hands of Lord Summerisle.
Well, it's the thing about the film, and I think to come back to the opening shots of the theatrical cut, when Howie arrives at Summer Isle, I think that first scene of him, as you mentioned earlier, sort of having that comedic back and forth about just trying to get onto the island proper, because he lands basically a seaplane there and needs somebody to come out row and bring him onto the island. And people are saying, well, you need Summer Isle's permission and other things. And the thing is, he starts throwing his authority around as a figure of the law and of queen and country around right from the minute he gets there.
He's
And
not wrong,
he's not wrong, but what I love about that sequence is the fact that, the entirety of his authority in this film is based upon the idea that anybody recognizes and cooperates with him. And this is a guy who has gone to an isolated community, has no backup, and he's entirely expecting that things will go his way just because, well, I'm the law, I'm here, and I'm going to put my foot down.
Well,
And he
especially
would.
the framing of all the people on the shore standing together in that, and then it reverse shots to Howie standing in a seaplane framed against the immense, or the expanse of the ocean, yelling into a bullhorn about how he needs to be taken seriously.
Yeah, exactly. And then you get things, other points throughout there where Howie is basically at certain points exceeding his authority, and I'm pretty sure that this is indeed the case. So, for example, there's that great exchange when he's speaking to the school teacher about how he's going to make sure that there's a report about them teaching sort of a pagan religion in here. And she's like, oh, I didn't know that this, education fell under the auspice of the police here, where it's like, it really doesn't in this instance. So, he's blustering for all sorts of reasons. And then when he goes to get documents, people keep pointing, well, there's a proper procedure for securing these things. And he starts throwing his weight around as if, well, I'm going to write you up a report on you and say you're obstructing justice if you don't just do as I say. And I mean, he notably goes in and he'll just take documents, which again, maybe I'm misunderstanding, I'm wrong about the way the law works in Scotland, particularly in 1973. I'm fairly confident he would need a warrant in most of these instances.
It's a special allowance. It's known as impromptu discovery. But yeah, and then there's the his first conversation with Summerisle as well, where he wants permission to exhume Rowan's body. And Summerisle like basically says, "Oh, of course, totally fine." And then they walk through the garden for about 10 minutes. Summerisle explains the history of the island and his own views. And by the end, how he is so flustered, he basically like stands up to him, starts yelling about how he's a pagan and that, and he demands to have the authority to exhume the body. And Summerisle just very casually is like, "Oh, I already gave it to you." And it's like, again, that sense of righteousness and sort of the the desire to be the righteous one and bring the full authority of the law to there, it blinds Howie from what's right in front of him, and in that case, it keeps him from even realizing that he already has what he needs.
Well, and that's exactly it. And that's why I love Edward Woodward in this in the role of Howie, because there is this really, stiff upper lip Britishness that he brings to the role here, and this very sort of authoritarian who, he really is the embodiment of the fool, because he never once realizes what he is. And the more bluster and the more, horrified he is, the more foolish he looks over the course of the film.
And that's sort
And
of the irony, because even long before he disguises himself as the fool, he has been playing one the entire film.
exactly. And it's really the film is in many ways, like, the plot description is so straightforward about this movie, and yet the layers of irony that exist throughout this thing, and the layers of meaning that happen throughout it, are so rich and so, interesting in what you can sort of pull out there. And we haven't even gotten into things such as, even questions about the notion of the Summerisle faith and, what Lord Summerisle's actual beliefs are. Because when you hear the history of, of the island and why things are, and the fact that, he's got everybody ultimately on this island to help get together and burn Howie in this giant wicker man as a way to restore the crops. But when you consider the history he gives, there, I think, is a legitimate question as to, does Lord Summerisle actually believe what he's doing? Because the way Lee plays it feels like he does. At the same time, he pretty much admits straight up that, this was an entire, this whole religion is more or less a manipulation tactic started by my grandfather
Yeah,
just to
he
get
almost like
everybody.
lovingly chuckles about it when he's detailing the history, where it's like, "Well, he needed the people to listen to him, so he gave them something to believe in. Ha ha ha. Walk with me."
Exactly. And you get to the end of this movie, and it almost becomes the question of, does he, because at the end there, it becomes this matter, this confrontation of faith, where he's basically, telling Howie, it's like, "No, I'm saying it. The crops are gonna come back once we've, burned you alive in this thing, along with a fistful of other farm animals." But, the question becomes, is he doing this to appease the islanders themselves in order to keep going with things the way they are? Or does he actually believe in this now? And if which case, what do we, reflect upon the history that he gives us earlier? Likewise, I love the final confrontation scene in terms of the way Lee plays it, where, there's almost this cheer he has, as Howie's insistence, like, "I am a true Christian, I am a believer." And he's like, "Yes, you're gonna be a martyr. We're gonna give you this awesome gift that you're gonna die,
Yeah,
standing up
because
for what you
yeah, he
believe."
frames it exactly as, "Well, if you're a man of faith, we will give you the greatest thing a man of faith could want, a martyr's death."
And then watching Howie basically from that moment forward start fumbling around and trying to convince her, it's like, no, seriously, don't kill me, it's not gonna help." And just the look of disappointment that Lee plays on his face, where it's like, oh, he's it's a lot more bluster than I thought. I mean, not that it changes his mind, but just, he feels disappointment that this isn't somebody who's as strong as he thought he was
But even
in his
prior to that,
conversions.
though, there's another interesting little, just a little shift in that scene where Howie, quite reasonably says, he's like, "And what happens if the crops fail next year?" And then it's almost like he plants that lasting seed in the community's mind where he's like, "If your crops don't come back, you'll have to sacrifice someone even greater than me. Nothing less than the Lord of Summer Isle will do." And Lee has that split second where he has the "Ugh, what now?" kind of look on his face, but then he very quickly doubles down by just being supremely confident of, "No, this will work. I know it will. It won't come to that." So by the end, like the way I read that scene, it's like, well, we have two different problematic interpretations and expressions of faith, and we're not really being asked to choose, I don't think. Instead, it's just sort of laying bare, deep down the fundamental similarities they have.
Yeah, and that's the interesting thing is because when you get right down to it, I mean, the ending is horrific, and I mean, certainly I don't blame anybody for being, scared witless by what they're seeing. And although I play again, it's one of these films where, it plays, I think, not so much as scary in the sense I think a lot of people that sort of jump scare feeling as so much as disturbing, because it's not comforting. It's not giving you an easy out, and the film doesn't really ultimately give you any answers because we don't see what the result of, the actions are. It's just, it happens. We pan over to the final shot of the sun over Summer Isle as the Wicker Man's burning, and that's the end of the movie.
See, I
We
want to
don't.
come back to that because I think that final shot does suggest something.
Okay, I'll be very curious about that because, to me, I mean, it certainly does reflect the certain notions of worshiping a sun deity, but it's one of those things where, again, how do we choose to read? Are we invoking that? Is this the film underscoring that there is, Summer Isle may be right, or is this more just an ambiguous pointing out to you? It's like, well, what do you think? It's like, we're not gonna say one way or the other, but here's the sun.
Oh, wouldn't it be
What?
so cool if, like, the final shot was the Wicker Man finally burning down, and then Christopher Lee just turns and looks at the camera and says, "Well, what do you think, folks?" It would not actually be tonally or stylistically at odds with the rest of the film. But yeah, like, I mean, this film, again, it's a fairly straightforward conflict, but this is a film that continually finds a way to undermine itself or prevent the audience from getting too solid of a footing. Because again, like, if the issue of religion versus agnosticism, or even religion A versus religion B, if they were simple issues, I mean, we would have settled them by now. But I think it's also, can't overlook the fact that, again, going back to sort of historical specificity, in 1973, if you and I, at the ages we were now, to watch this film, I have a feeling we'd probably identify more with the people of Summer Isle, because they basically are flower children for all practical purposes. But
And I'm sorry.
again, though, it's not something that stabilizes well because Summer Isle, again, has basically talked about how, well, I come from a long line of snake oil salesmen. We just happen to live on an island full of gullible people. And so if the question is that we're supposed to read, like, the villagers as kind of symptomatic of 70s counterculture, the movement away from fundamentalist religion, sort of the embrace of human sexuality, the natural world, distrust of institutions. At the same time, they're all overseen by someone who is transparently co-opting them.
No, absolutely. And I think we can't overlook the fact that this is a film written by Anthony Schaefer. And Anthony Schaefer is somebody who, at the time he would have written this, would have been in his mid to late 40s. So putting him sort of squarely it, at enough remove from the counterculture generation to be able to possibly, be considered part of the old guard. And it's kind of interesting to consider, If we're looking at this again at that sort of text bordering on, or subtext bordering on text element of this film, is there sort of a, is the film sort of, is there a level of hippie paranoia on this thing? This, don't trust any, the kids, don't trust these, people like Tim Leary and other, sort of countercultural figureheads
Well, yeah,
that are
because the
out there.
fact remains, even if you find like the reasoning and the philosophy of Summer Isle to be valid or something you agree with, there's no getting around the fact that at the end of the film, the entire village commits a murder. So, there's still that threat there. And just going back to a way, like another way that the film sets up sort of the dualism among the characters is, I mean, it. Christopher Lee is most famous for playing the character of Dracula. Is that a fair statement to make?
I would say, particularly at this point, that was what he was most famous for. I
Yes,
could
in
say that,
1973, pre-Lord of the Rings and Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Christopher Lee certainly is strongly associated with Dracula. I mean, through Hammer Pictures, he played the role a good number of times, and I think a UK audience would make a pretty strong connection. And I think it's really interesting reading Summer Isle in terms of that, because again, like when he's first introduced, we see him in the shadows as he's calling to Willow, introducing her to Ash Buchanan. But then he has that weird little monologue about religion, and he's cloaked in shadows as he does it. And especially when we think about him and sort of the associations of the vampiric, like aesthetically, he's presented more or less consistent with that. Everyone else is wearing like common garb, but he is dressed to the nines. And like the vampire itself, like literary terms, has always functioned as an inversion of Christianity and its rituals. And I think some of those extend to Summer Isle as well, especially the idea that he is the one who made the crops grow and made the island habitable. I mean, that's this weird sort of mirror to the story of Jesus on the Mount with the loaves and the fishes, right? It's just he is linked to faith in nature and the natural, whereas Howie is linked to faith in the word of God and trusting that everything will be okay. Am I reading too much into it or making a point where there isn't one?
No, I don't think you're reading too much into it. I mean, and to come back to the horror, to the Hammer connection, I think the thing with, particularly with the Dracula thing, that I think tends to get overlooked, with Lee's participation in the role, at least as far as the first film he did, The Horror of Dracula. Let's put the sequels and table them aside for a minute there. I think one of the interesting things that people tend to overlook about that movie is the way that is that that film, to me, is almost a deliberate middle finger in some way to Bram Stoker's text and the versions that had preceded it. Because the film opens up not with Dracula as this invading force coming to get you. It opens up with Jonathan Harker coming into his home, invited to do a job, and Harker is basically shows up under false pretenses, murders Dracula's bride. And then the rest of the movie is Dracula after basically his home's been invaded, and that's happened. He says, "To hell with all of you, I'm coming to your home, and I'm gonna screw things up for everybody else." And that's a
Isn't
simple.
that Luke Cage's introduction in Marvel Comics as well?
I'm not entirely sure, but certainly, to me, it's one of those things where I remember I did write a review somewhere about that, and somebody was like, "No, Dracula's a force of evil," and it's like, yeah, because we all associate him as being a very particularly evil individual. I think it's very clear and very clever the way that film structures Dracula as a more ambiguous figure, and arguably the one who's in the wrong in that film, because the only reason you associate him with being evil right from the get-go is because you've had the Bela Lugosi version preceding it. You've had the famed, Bram Stoker novel preceding it. And I think that's kind of something that if we're, again, I can't speak more or less to the sequels there and how that sort of would have impacted audiences' perceptions of Lee in the role of Lord Summerisle. But I think there is something sort of noteworthy coming back to these are characters who aren't necessarily as straightforward as you may think at first, as per se.
Well, yeah, because we see how he gradually lose control and, you know, lose the thread of his investigation. But they're similar play with Summerisle, where, you know, that introduction to him certainly comes off as menacing. And the way that, you know, the sequence is edited and the music is mixed, because it's cross-cutting between close-ups of Summerisle's face, shots through the window of Willow and Ash Buchanan, and then shots of Howie kneeling at his bed and praying. And this is one of those moments where it's not entirely clear if the sound is diegetic or not, because the way that it's all edited, it could be the case where Howie can hear him being taunted by this guy he hasn't met yet, but at the same time, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense if it is diegetic. But even like Summerisle, you know, he's menacing, but then he's this absolute gentleman when he has Howie over. They're walking through the gardens in the sunlight. He's dressed like a dandy and playing the piano. And, you know, he seems like a cultured, suave kind of guy. So, yeah, again, like, this film doesn't really congeal into anything in that regard.
Well, yeah, and I mean, it really does leave the film open to an intense degree of interpretation where, I mean, it really has set you down, you know, here's the parameters we're working in. Now, you have to make sense of it, ultimately, in terms of what you're going to take away from it. And it doesn't really come down one way or the other, although I would say, certainly, the treatment of Howie at the end and his sort of, you know, understandable, like, I mean, let's be clear, his understandable terror at being burned alive, like,
yeah, we'll give him that one.
Yeah, at that point, but there is that sense of, you know, there is something almost sad about him by that point, and in some way you almost have to kind of pity him to a degree. Although part of me almost wishes that this is a film which would have, you know, imagine if this entire film, if it instead been Peter Falk's Columbo investigating it from, like, start one. Then, lo and behold, after the whole mystery solved, turns out there's been snipers on the island from the local police all there the entire time, because he foresaw the need.
Yeah. Any final words? Yeah, just one more thing. It's, yeah, like, I think also that final scene is kind of interesting, because it's hard not to feel bad for Howie in that he thought he was doing the right thing, he had the best of intentions, and he wanted to solve what he thought was a crime. And even at the end, though, there's still, like, that dual reading, where we can see the fact that as he's reciting Psalm 23, and the wicker man is burning around him, like, his voice gets more frantic and panicked, like, he loses his composure. So you can see it as sort of like his faith is failing him in his final moments. But you can also look at it in terms of, but he continues to say it. You know, he basically gets through until he burns to death. So again, like, it sort of resists an easy answer. And I think that's also just pretty shrewd, you know, because especially a film coming out at a time of, like, generational and social upheaval, you know, I feel like if you were to look at a lot of other, you know, late 1960s, early 70s films, I feel like they would eventually put the post down hard on one side of the line of sort of what side they're on. Whereas, yeah, that doesn't seem to be what this film is concerned with. But it's also not a film that's purely concerned with its aesthetics either. It's, and again, like, everything about this film, it's like you can pull it one way or you can pull it the other way, and both are sustainable readings.
Yeah, and I almost want to say, and this might sound kind of mean-spirited to say it, but I think part of what helps is that I don't think we can really call director Rob Hardy an auteur, because I don't get the sense that he is a great director. But I think the fact that he, part of the genius of this movie comes from the fact that much of its ambiguity probably comes from the fact that he didn't put a really definitive stamp on it. in some way, where you get the feeling that he is trying to lead you down a very specific path, and you know, this sort of notice me approach to directing.
Yeah,
But I
it's
think a
not
lot
a
of them.
Hitchcockian kind of narrative.
Yeah, no, it's not. And I think it's very telling that when you look at things like years later, when he did The Wicker Tree, the pseudo sequel spiritual follow up to this film, which is a total debacle.
I haven't seen it, but yeah, reading about its production history, I'm like, I'm not terribly motivated to see it either, so.
Again, it's one of those. It's the thing about that one that's really depressing is it actually has a kernel of a good idea, which is the idea you take a fundamentalist American, you know, pair of Texans, you know, who are very much part of that youthful, devote your life to Christ, you know, abstinence is key, and all these sorts of things, and then take them and put them into a Summer Isle-like situation. That sort there's so much potential in that notion of that sort of, again, cross-cultural or confrontation, because now we're taking it out of specifically this sort of very, you know, British context, this idea of with being within the UK. Because again, the part of the you know the thing that's sort of interesting about this film is it's not that Howie's going really outside the borders of the United Kingdom itself. He is still firmly within English soil. I mean, there's that great line he points out where you still are part of a Christian nation with a you know led by what is it a Christian ruler or something like that. I'm butchering the line, but
It's something to that effect, though. And
yeah.
yeah, but it's like, you know, the division between like urban and rural America,
Yeah.
it seems less pronounced than, especially in the 1970s, like the divide between cosmopolitan areas like London versus like the actual villages that have remained the way they were since they were put up during the Enlightenment. And especially the fact that Summer Isle is an island for all practical purposes. It is a completely foreign world.
Exactly. And, you know, I think to come back to the Wicker Tree for a second, I think there is something interesting about that idea of suddenly, well, let's put in this sort of cross nationality into this, where suddenly it's still within the Western nations, but suddenly we have this very, you know, fundamentalist, you know, Christianity in America means something, I think, very different than what that means in terms of, you know, Anglican religions in the UK. And unfortunately, the film takes no advantage of that to do anything meaningful or interesting, and it's a crushing disappointment to look at that. But I digress.
Fisk, fisk. They can't all be winners.
No.
But yeah, like again, it's also interesting because especially from the 50s onward, with the introduction of atomic weaponry, there's definitely a thread in horror and sci-fi where it's not just fear of the repressed returning as much as it's fear of the unknown, fear of the speculative. And that's where we get movies like The Thing from Outer Space, or The Blob, or Robot Monster. And but again, like that sort of the common fears of the time, looking towards the future and what we don't understand. But this, The Wicker Man, it's like the fear is of the fear is of like the neo-paganism, where to Howie, how do I put it? It's he sees like the pagan rituals of the island as terrifying because almost like we move beyond that in a sense, but at the same time it also predates like the anglicization of religion, you know? So it also occupies like its weird slippage where it's something that is both new in that it's a new set of values to Howie, but it's also very, very old at the same time. So I think that's really what drives that feeling of uncanniness, that unknown within the familiar. And I think it's because the film's like threats occupy that position. That's why, in some part, it's so unsettling.
Well, it is, and I not that this is a again, this is not a post-colonialist film, but there is something to be said about the fact that much of Howie's ideology and his sort of perspective on the world is very much of that of there's something still of the lingering British Empire to it.
Well,
This
yeah, I
idea.
can do what I do by right of God and by right of the Queen.
Exactly, and that's, you know, here we have basically what seems to be the hotbed of turning that on its head, right, not necessarily in the heart of Britain, but it's certainly within the body, the political and social body of the country itself. And ultimately, for how, I mean, does this, Summer Isle end up being this sort of existential threat to it? And again, I mean, if you wanted to make almost an interesting sequel to this film, barring or putting the Wicker Tree aside, revisiting Summer Isle, a whole, 20, 30 years later to see what's become of things might have been an interesting idea. I mean, they would probably have botched it, but there is something interesting about seeing, well, what has become it with of that within the context of the modern UK, particularly as there is this continued pushback against these sort of colonial underpinnings and this idea of what did the British Empire do at its height and how it got there in the first place.
Well, yeah, and like Summer Isle's position as being remote yet still a part of things, like, it's the island is just like the mystery where everything is hiding in plain sight. We just don't recognize it until it's too late.
Yeah, exactly. And I, again, it's things that, again, none of this is necessarily the text of the film, but it's all there. It's all, just boiling there beneath the surface and, at points sort of almost rupturing onto the surface. And, I could easily see an audience who either doesn't know their history, they don't understand, where this film is positioned, kind of looking at this and maybe being bored, even at the, with the 87-minute running time. But I think there's so much richness there, that I have a hard, I would hope people would be willing to, to really dig into it and take something out of it.
Well, yeah, it's a film where not a lot happens, but everything that happens is meaningful.
Yeah, and I mean, even, to come back to this notion of the fact that there are alternative cuts, which we sort of danced around throughout the this conversation,
Yeah, right
because
before we started recording, we were trying to figure out what the actual history of this film is.
yeah, and good luck figuring that one out, folks, because certainly with the resources we had at hand, we couldn't put a definitive pin on anything. We do know, and the version we watched of this film was what's the 87-minute or 88, depending upon how you want to do the rounding on the seconds, cut of this movie, which was the one that was released in theaters back in 73. But ostensibly, there was a longer director's cut that had a bunch of stuff or scenes preceding or with Howie prior to him coming to Summer Isle, featuring his life on the mainland. Supposedly, I guess at one point it was revealed that he wasn't just a devout Christian, he was actually a preacher of some sort at some point. Presumably, I would imagine prior to his time as a police officer, there. And additional scenes, sort of the chronology of the film being a little more linear than it is. Not that this is a terribly unlinear movie to start with, in
Yeah,
this
it's
80.
entirely linear.
Yeah, like,
By excising the flashbacks, that just reinforces that even further.
exactly. And the thing about it is, while part of me is very curious to want to see this missing footage, I don't feel like this is a film that is in any way hampered by whatever's missing. Like, it feels like a complete work that has everything it needs, from start to finish. And I kind of almost would dread the notion of there being stuff at preceding the arrival in Summer Isle, because there is something to be said for the fact that we're dropped right into the middle of this with Howie, right from the get-go. And, we're the only things we have are him and his behavior and the people of Summer Isle itself. And I kind of like that weird sort of, where are we, feeling that you have to sort of work your way through for most of it. And I feel if you added stuff to the start of this, you would probably lose that.
Yeah, I think as is. I mean, because again, like going through its history here, there's oh well, there was a the complete restoration, which was 96 minutes, and then they came out with the super complete restoration, which was 90 minutes, and it's just bouncing around. And I don't think anyone's ever been able to find the original master, but You know, there are some films where director's cuts are a fundamentally different movie, and I don't know if that is the case with this one, but I worry that it would be, because I don't want this to be a different movie than what we see on the screen, because yeah, it works perfectly well for what it is.
Well, and that's exactly it. I mean, this is not a case where, I mean, and maybe, you know, I'm willing to be wrong. I mean, I am not objecting to seeing, you know, things like the final cut that apparently is now out, which I don't even know whether that constitutes a director's cut whatsoever, because there is something listed as the director's cut that precedes that. So
Yeah.
it's like I honestly don't know. And Rob Hardy has passed away, so I'm not positive whether he's ever gone on, you know, made a real clear definitive statement as to which is his preferred version of the cuts that have come out since the theatrical cut. But yeah, I mean, as long as the theatrical cut continues to exist, and this doesn't become a George Lucas-esque situation where the originals are kind of banished into a vault somewhere, I
Yeah.
mean,
And then they'll release it 20 years later, and the Wicker Man's purely CGI.
Oh man, Rob Hardy had some weird notions he wanted to toss in there. That dancing Edward Woodward scene was also kind of a little bit weird. But anyways, I digress. But yeah, so I mean, you have their options. I would really strongly recommend that anybody who we've made curious about this, presuming you haven't seen this movie prior to listening to this podcast. I mean, I'd like to assume that everybody has either seen it or at least knows about it before listening to us spoil the hell out of it. But if you were that, you know, very narrow niche of people who decided that, yeah, I'm going to watch, listen to this movie I've never seen and listen to these guys talk about it for like about an hour and a half, yeah, start with the theatrical cut. I really would strongly suggest you do that because if nothing else, it gives you a great grounding for everything that's going to come
Well,
afterwards.
yeah, and the film is very focused. And just reflecting on that idea, I mean, we've, you know, there's not a whole lot going on in terms of the film's plot, but it all hinges around that central conflict. And as a result, like we spent the better part of an hour just talking about that conflict itself. So I mean, yeah, like it's a fairly streamlined movie. Like maybe it's not the most thrilling in that, you know, there aren't really any set pieces right up until the end of the film, but I think it more than makes up for it in terms of like a narrative payoff to everything that it's building towards. But again, like yeah, there's it's very streamlined, it's just very focused, and along the way it keeps throwing curveballs at you, which is interesting. You know, maybe it's not a pure horror film, but I think it certainly does some interesting attempts to play with the idea of horror itself.
One thing actually we haven't brought up that I would be curious to get your feeling towards, because it's probably the one element where I don't, maybe it's a bit too cutesy, I guess, which is the opening title card of this film, about, you know, getting this film, you know, being allowed access to the Summer Isle to film the peculiar customs of the people there.
Yeah, that's a bit too much like Baz Luhrmann opening the film with curtains raising, you know? It's again like it's quirky, it's a weird affectation. I don't think it adds anything. I don't think like it feels like they're trying to double down in a sense where it's like, no, this is a real place and these are real things that happen here. The same way Cannibal Holocaust was, oh, everybody, it's a real thing we recorded.
I like
No,
that that's
I
where you
think that's
went.
more of a distraction than anything.
Yeah, and I don't disagree. I mean, part of it then begs the question, it's like, well, if this is supposedly a document that we're watching, it's like nobody went to the police while they were filming this. We're just gonna let the man
Exactly.
burn.
Like, the diegesis of the film is plausible enough without that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it really does seem out of place to me. I mean, again, cutesy just seems, it's almost like the sort of wink wink at the start of the film where it's like, okay, fine. I guess,
Well,
I mean,
yeah.
it doesn't ruin the movie by any stretch of the imagination. It's just sort of like, you're right, an unnecessary affectation that doesn't
Well, it's just when
matter.
you're in a film where there are so many idiosyncrasies and just like little subversions of expectation and moments where it steadfastly refuses to conform, most of them work well and to great effect. And this one stands out as being one of the only ones that doesn't. Instead of going, we go, huh? And that's a crucial difference sometimes.
Yeah, it is, but yeah, so I guess I is there anything left to say before we hit into the hits and pits segment of this program that you want to touch upon, Andrew?
I think compared to Machine Gun McCain, we'll actually be able to fill out this section. So I think we've summarized the main threads and the main points to take away from this one. And I would just close out by saying that, yeah, watch this movie because it's great.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It is just a sheer it's a great movie. It's a great horror film, and if you haven't seen it, really get your hands on a copy. You're not going to regret it.
Well, yes, but gotta say though, every film is like an elevator repairman's life. It's got its ups and downs, and that's what takes us to our patent-pending bumper segment, Hits and Pits,
That's
where we
right.
talk about the smaller things.
Yeah, they rescinded the patent after last episode. I'm sorry, folks. But we're
Yeah, so we
reapplying.
filed a new one, gotta wait a little bit. Hopefully, even if it's drawn out, hopefully I'll be done college then so I can at least process the forms. So
Excellent.
David, as the passenger, you get first choice on this one. What is one of the hits that we haven't hit upon yet?
I'm gonna small call out to Aubrey Morris as the old gardener slash gravedigger. That man has got one of the greatest faces in genre history. I mean, he didn't have a long career in terms of the sheer number of credits, but anytime he pops up, he's just got this great smirking face that is just a delight. I mean, even in something as terrible as Bordello of Blood, where he pop that he's in, he's just a sheer delight in the way in which he plays off of Edward Woodward in their few scenes together. Is amazing. Even just watching him in the end as everybody's singing, like he is super into, yeah, we're burning a man alive. And he's
Here
just so
comes
happy.
the corn.
Exactly. It's like we're coming to the chorus. Everybody, make sure we're getting in there. It's just like, again, just a small little detail. He doesn't have a major role, but God bless him. I love him in this one. What about you, Andrew? What's your first pick here?
I think this may be almost too general, but because we didn't really talk about it much, I would say the performances of the cast as a whole, in particular Woodward and Lee.
Yeah.
Lee, he is well within his wheelhouse. It's not necessarily like stepping out into this role for him, but he is exactly what Summer Isle needs to be for all of this to work. He is a confident and handsome and like just he's a man of the people. And he's incredibly stylish. He's charming. Like, it's easy to see why people listen to this guy. If he was just like the unseen figure brooding in a castle, beg the question of why everyone seems content to do what they do and stay where they are. But I think Edward Woodward as Howie, I really, really enjoy how he plays the role because it's one of those things that could very easily tip into self-parody.
Yeah.
And I mean, his performance is sort of meant to be wooden in a certain way, but the way that he plays off like his own inner conflicts as the film progresses and those cracks start to show, and especially by the end when he's allowed to be emotional, I think he gives a great performance and one that does require a certain degree of nuance. And as a sub hit within that, I love when Willow is offering him food, how he says turquoise as turquoise. I've noticed that every time, and I never fail to giggle.
Yeah, no, Woodward's one of those guys who, I mean, he had a really good solid career, but I don't think he ever got the credit he sort of deserved as an actor. Not that he was bad, it's just, or that he got a ton of terrible roles or anything. It's just he's somebody I think we've all kind of forgotten about in the years since. And that's a shame because he really is a talented actor. And I mean, even scenes such as, again, to come to another Howie Willow scene when she's doing her Disney princess singing siren routine. Again, I just can't help but picture her just, singing to the birds at moments. Like, it's how they flutter onto her finger. But,
Well, especially how it looks like she's looking directly at the audience in some shots.
exactly.
You wouldn't be terribly wrong.
Yeah, but I mean, look at Woodward and how he's playing his. He plays that scene in the other room as he is tempted and really conflicted over there. I mean, his hand gestures as he's just against the wall are, you know, just again, it communicates so much by doing very minimal. And that's not something that's easy, many actors can do. Honestly, the only one other one that comes to mind of that skill is someone like Bruno Ganz, who, God bless him, watch him in The American Friend and some of the very subtle acting he gets to do in that film. He is just a master at communicating so much with so little. And Woodward, at least in this film, certainly is up to par on that note. So.
Well, you kind of preempted my next hit, but do you have another?
In terms of a hit, and I should probably, you know, it's a good thing. It's a curious thing because we really have hit upon most of the major elements of this film I would want to identify. But I should again give note to probably again the way in which Rob Hardy, and we sort of mentioned this already, but the way in which the film has this very lived-in reality that's there. Now, it probably helps that he was shooting completely on location. Nothing in this movie looks as if it was shot on a set at any point, unless you can think of one to identify offhand, Andrew.
Nope. I'm pretty sure, yeah, all pure location.
Yeah, and but the way in which he sort of just soaks it in, and again, having been to Scotland, there, I mean, there is a real. It captures the atmosphere of these places, of these little small, you know, communities, and there is this real attention to detail. And I like the fact that, you know, this isn't a built-up sort of fake or overwrought community. It really does feel like these are your next-door neighbors. These are the people you know from down the street, and you know the fact that, I mean, again, a great sequence is. You know, late in the game, when Howie is sneaking into the May Day Festival, there's the scene where basically Summer Isle is gathering everybody together and basically saying, okay, this is how the day's gonna go. You know, we're gonna go start here, we're gonna march down this way, you know,
We're
stay,
going to
you know.
throw beer in the ocean here.
Exactly. It's this really small town community. Like, it's not this big, and again, you could see this in another type of film where it would be this very ritualistic, dark thing that they're doing. But it's, no, it's like, okay, we just got the community together. We got some, you know, boards. We got some, a couple of the neighbors had some swords. We're gonna, you know, put on our best show with what little we've got,
Yeah,
and
we're gonna
it's
party. Like, it's a
exactly.
joyous celebration. And that,
Yeah.
again, going back to like the way the film plays with identification, it's like, well, are these things evil or malicious, in and of themselves, or are they evil and malicious for what they represent? And, well, what do they represent in the case of Howie? It's these are people who have turned their back on the one true faith, and regardless of what they're doing, that's why they're going to be the most terrifying thing in the world.
Exactly. And yeah, I mean, Rob Hardy, again, whether it's because he didn't overthink it or wasn't, you know, over guiding things, or maybe because, you know, he did have that kind of foresight to pull it off. I mean, I really think does a great job of communicating that in this film and, you know, not overselling it,
Yeah, and
which.
there's something to be said for not making like a monster movie or something where it requires fantastic technology or a guy running around in a rubber suit. Like, this is very naturalistic despite the weirdness of the music and the enormous Wicker Man that burns at the end. You know, like this really does feel like commonplace. Everything that happens that the villagers do that Howie sees as suspicious is commonplace.
Yeah, no, exactly, and that's the thing. And so much, particularly of modern horror, that really frustrates me is that sort of lived-in reality that we become further and further removed from. Because, again, you know, even many of the great recent horror films that are out there, you know, there is a slicked-up quality to them that sort of really distances it, even when it's, you know, talking about common everyday locations and people, where suddenly, you know. everybody looks like they've just walked out of, you know, a catalog shoot.
Yeah, it's any town USA, more models per capita than anywhere else.
Exactly. And I mean, you know, that's not to, you know, disregard the performances of the actors, but again, there is something about the idea of just, you know, these are people in everyday clothes dressed up, you know, like anybody you would encounter on the screen, and they haven't been prettied up to make it, you know, this film look like it cost $1 million to do it, that I really appreciate and kind of wish a lot many more horror filmmakers would go back to. There is something to be said for that. So.
Well, yeah, because when evil and danger is not codified as being like visually distinct from you and I, you know, it becomes easier to other. Whereas here, like, it presents it as more insidious, and I think that's what gives the film its lasting creepiness. But I guess for my final hit, though, which you introduced, I would say the music, both the selections and its orchestration by Paul Giovanni, as well as its incorporation into the film as sequences, I think is very interesting. It's unique. And in particular, I do want to highlight Willow's song, just because the staging and the composition of that sequence, it's like a miniature music video. And apparently, I don't know how much faith to place in this, but apparently Hardy said that his use of music in the film was influenced heavily by Nicholas Roeg and Donald Camel's performance, which is always going to win points, because I think performance is probably the best film of all time. And I'll put money on that. But with the Willow sequence, it's so interesting because the music begins in the cafe, the floor above, and then it's that weird droning, like, bass drum beat. But then we cut through, and we see that it's Willow's hand tapping against the wall. And then she starts singing, and then Howie responds as if he hears, and she's singing directly to him. And again, there's that weird play between three linked but disconnected areas. It's not clear whether or not, like, they'd be able to hear one another diegetically, but the film sort of goes in and out assuming that it does. And by the time that, like, the words she's singing and her dancing suggestively at the wall, the moment that they match hands, Howie, like, returns and basically doubles down on prayer, like, oh, it's such a wonderful little sequence. I think it's masterfully composed, and it is, oh, it's just so cool, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't disagree with you with it.
Like, however, all the musical sequences are interesting, but I think that one stands out the most in terms of what it's doing and how it brings its formal and narrative registers into alignment.
No, you know, you're not wrong, because at that, I mean, nothing really clicks quite like that in the same way from the rest of the film. Certainly not in terms of the music and editing patterns, but this does sort of bring us to the pits, though, and it's hard to want to sort of really lambast anything in this movie because so much of it is good, but there are one or two minor kinks. And I think while we just, you know, gave a lot of credit to the sequels we noted here, it would be hard not to talk about Britt Eklund a little bit more, because
you stole my other pit as well.
Dang it.
Let's see what your reasons are.
The thing about it is I think she works incredibly well in this film. She does the role that is asked of her. The thing about it is, as you sort of noted in our notes, there's the question of, A, how much of this can we credit to her? Because it seems like she's been overdubbed the entire movie.
There are apparently separate overdubs for her singing voice and for her speaking voice.
And the thing is, it's not a badly done dub job. Like, this, it's not one that's overtly obvious.
Certainly an improvement over Machine Gun McCain.
Yeah. The thing about it is again, if you know Britt Eklund, that's not her voice. And again, not to diminish her talents, she's not known as the best actor out there.
She's an it girl, Dave. I mean, they're not known for their bravura performances.
No, and on one hand, I feel bad, you know, listing this as a pit, because it's not that there's anything objectively wrong with her in the film. It's just when you have a cast that's this good and this strong in achieving so much, she really doesn't get a heck of a lot more to play other than being the siren. Number one. And number two, that's a role that's pretty much dependent upon talents that we can objectively say she does not have to pull off in terms of her singing voice and speaking voice for this film, particularly given the cultural context of where she's supposed to be located.
Exactly. It's thick Swedish accent being like, "Ayo, welcome to Scotland."
Yeah,
I'm
exactly.
never gonna try and do a voice ever again. But yeah,
But
like the part that drives me insane about it is that apparently, aside from some shots during that sequence, they used a body double. So Britt Eklund doesn't speak, doesn't sing, and we don't even see her naked. So really, like, is it even fair to give her a credit for this film? Like, I mean, I think there's an interesting reading you can make of going back to Laura Mulvey and the idea of the camera as representing the male gaze. Well, in that sense, no, if that's all true, no wonder people liked Britt Eklund, because she did nothing more than be looked at, and half the time it wasn't even her.
Well, like I said, I'm not going to blame the I'm not going to lambast the use of a body double, because again, I got this weird thing in terms of actors and nudity, because on an objective level, I'm not going to say that there isn't a place for nudity in a film, because I
But
think
she
there are.
looks straight at the camera while she's topless, so clearly it wasn't that big of a problem.
It was, but I think A, as the past how many months since of the Me Too movement's been going on, what it require, what she may have been put pressured into or not pressured into, is one thing I don't think we'll ever know unless she chooses to speak on the record about it.
Yeah, that's a valid point.
But beyond putting that aside, it's also one of these things where I'm trying to imagine, trying to position myself as a director. I don't think I certainly don't think I would ever have it within me to sit there and say, no, there is a strategic reason why you have to be nude to do this scene. Like, I would probably do everything in my power to not do that. And it's one of those things where, again, objectively, I see why it's there, because it is part and parcel of the themes of this movie. You can't get away from that there. And certainly, she's not the only one to engage in nudity in this film. Throughout it's one of those things where if it had been me in charge, I probably would have been said, a bathrobe is not a bad thing in this sequence. I don't think that's going to change
Yeah,
the
but
nature of
pagan gods didn't wear bathrobes.
I know,
Studying oppositions. Congrats, David. If you had your wish, this movie would be ruined. Well, I mean, before Neil LaBute ended up ruining it for us anyway. Do you have any others? I have one that isn't Britt Eklund.
Feel free, because it was your turn next anyway.
Okay. I would just say that for a film where so much of it hinges on plausibility, there's that one leap in logic that just, again, it stands out more because the rest of the film is so consistent. When Howie first realizes that Rowan actually was on the school roster and that everybody just straight up lied to his face, he has his little moment of outburst. But why is that not a massive red flag? Like, why doesn't he just fly back to the mainland right there and then? And I mean, I think there is a way that you can make sense of it where he won't let go of the case. Like, and moreover, he has convinced himself that only he is the one who can affect justice. But that's one of those moments where it's like, well, it happens that way because the plot of the film requires it to happen that way. I mean, if he leaves, there's no sacrifice, and if there's no sacrifice, there's no film. So, I mean, I get it, but I feel like that's the one moment where you're like, really? Like, how many things do you need to see before you can take that as probable cause, I guess is the question.
Well, it's one of those things, I agree with you, and it certainly also begs the question of why Howie arrives on this island by himself entirely as well. Again, taking into allowances for how, police work was done in the 70s in the United Kingdom. But having said that, I'm still reasonably sure in an investigation like this, if you're saying that there's somebody missing, I would suspect that at least two officers would probably be dispatched, if only, for logistical reasons, not just a single one. But again, I am willing to make the allowance in this instance for the rest of the film to happen because, as you acknowledge here, the rest of it is so tightly constructed, I'm willing to go with it. That said, again, Columbo wouldn't have done that. He would have had somebody sneak onto the island out at another point in time and be right there as his backup.
Yeah, but he was too busy being in Machinga McCain at this point in time.
This is true. Although, again, Summer Isle is kind of a perfect, you know, individual for a Columbo investigation. He's wealthy, you know, he's, you know, glamorous. He's played by, you know, a reasonably sized star. Columbo caught them all the time. So I'm just saying, very different movie out there that we could have had.
I have a feeling you and I are going to be writing a lot of spec scripts this summer, and all of them are going to begin with the title Columbo Meets.
Yep.
I mean, it worked for Abbott and Costello.
This is true. Hopefully ours ends up better than a lot of those, like, Laurel and Hardy, like, they had that film in the 90s where other actors were recreating their shtick, or that Three Stooges movie. Like, I feel like there's the danger of Columbo of doing that, but...
Happened to the Marx Brothers, too. Brain Donors, which is such a weird concept for a film. I do like that one Laurel and Hardy film, though, where it ends with Hardy being trapped inside a giant wicker man and being burned to death. But yes, before we start ranting about other movies that are weird, do you have any final pits to throw in?
Not really. I mean, it's like, there's nothing about this movie that I think is really... there's nothing about it that is so egregious. Anything else would be like super minor nitpicks, and not even many of those are coming to mind.
Yeah, like, this is a film with quibbles, but no real outright problems.
Yeah.
I mean, and like, this film isn't really meant to be like a bravura piece. Like, it's clear that they were on a constrained budget. It's clear that, you know, they had to be a little creative with some of the sequences and just what the production budget allowed them to do. But I think, you know, it certainly works. And I mean, like, again, I think I've said before, but my metric for looking at movies is, I'm never going to hate on an absolutely terrible movie that screened at Sundance and was shot for $30,000. You know, because you can't assume that every film wants to do the same thing or is able to. I have a lot more anger for movies like Interstellar, where they have a budget, they have time, they have studio resources, and they're trying to make great art with it, and it ends up being absolute garbage. Like, even though Interstellar is objectively a better film than Sharknado, I am always going to hate Interstellar so much more. And so I think, like, this is certainly not a perfect film or even one of the all-time greats, but I think for what it is, it works amazingly well, and it achieves everything it sets out to do.
No, you're absolutely right. Although I'm now really piqued to try and get you to watch Phantasm Ravager, just to see how far I can push that. I'm not going to get mad at a film without any resources. Just to see. I'm very curious, but...
we can make it our one-year anniversary special. A detour, if you will.
Indeed. But yeah, so yeah, I guess that pretty much brings us to the end of The Wicker Man. So
Let me just shift into reverse. Now, we are on Summer Isle, so you'll want to keep on the left side. So where are you taking us next, Dave?
You know, I feel, you know, we've covered a lot of horror recently. We've done a lot of, you know, adult thrillers and crime movies and ostensibly comedies aimed at adults. I feel it's time we shake it up, Andrew.
Okay.
Really do something different. And you would think that, you know,
Bollywood.
Yeah, not that different. But, you know, you say Christopher Lee, and odds are you would think that, hey, if we're going to follow him, we're going to end up at a different horror movie or one of the big films he did in the 2000s. But no, I'm going to do something a little different. I think we're going to go take a look at not only our first animated film.
Woo!
But our first family-friendly movie.
Woo!
So, you know what, Andrew? You can finally, you know, have a film on this show that you can share with your daughter.
Well, I mean, I shared The Wicker Man, but I'm also a terrible father.
I'm not going to question this. But yeah, so for our next one, we're going back to the 80s to talk about The Last Unicorn, starring Christopher Lee, Jeff Bridges, Mia Farrow, and one Angela Lansbury. So,
just for continuity's sake, Dave, I haven't seen the first or subsequent Unicorns. Will I be able to follow the plot?
I think you're going to do just fine. So this is going to be an interesting one to take a look at. And it's been a while since I last watched it, so I'm very intrigued to revisit it and see how well it holds up there.
All right. Well, I'm flying blind, but I am just going to have faith and hope that it doesn't lead me to the same fate as Sergeant Howie. And also, Dave, if you're wrong about this film, I am going to light you on fire.
Well, you didn't do it after, you know, Where the Buffalo Roams, so I think
that was your mulligan. It's going to happen one day. But until that happens, you can find us here approximately each and every week. Currently, you can find us probably easiest on iTunes. If you like what you're hearing, or if you have somewhat constructive criticism, feel free to rate, review. 5-star reviews are the best way to build our listening audience, which, against all odds, is somehow growing. Otherwise, Dave, how can people get in touch with you?
Well, if you head over to Twitter, you can find me at 24Panels. And I believe you can find Andrew at FilmStripper on Twitter as well. And that's probably the best places to find us. You'll find plenty of interaction. You will find many, you know, jokes about really random tangents and subjects that may or may not actually be funny.
Yeah, it's like a transcript of this episode.
Yeah, pretty much. You'll find whatever, you know, deals I found at, you know, conventions. And, you know, wonder why on earth anybody would think that that was a worthwhile use of your money.
And you will also find my favorite thing about Twitter. Dave spree-watching critically reviled films from the 1980s and trying to encourage everyone to realize that they're not as bad as you would think.
This is true. Like I said, the 80s provided us a lot of great stuff, and a lot of stuff that, at the very least, its heart was in the right place. So, but yeah.
Hey, I'm from the 80s, and you can say the same thing about me.
There you go, folks. Until next time, what parting words will you leave us with, Andrew?
Yes. Remember, fellow travelers, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you. Unless Lord Summerisle does it first.
And he will. Bye.